Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we're checking in with FXX's unconventional, sort of romantic, sort of comedy, You're the Worst, which is entering its third season. Then, because that's a show that brings a lot of drama to its comedy and vice versa, we'll talk about the intermingling of the comedic and the dramatic. When does something serious make a laugh deeper, and when does a laugh help build dramatic stakes? And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
This week, we're conducting a brief survey to learn more about who's listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour and how you're using NPR podcasts. Please visit npr.org/PCHHsurvey to complete the survey. It would really help us out. Thank you so much.
Talking about You're the Worst is just the best this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books and other stuff for the NPR website.
And joining us from NPR in New York is our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katzeff, and Pal for Life, of course. Now, Mike, when you are not busy being the person who wants produced this podcast, what do you do with yourself?
I'm the producer for Ask Me Another, one of the producers.
It's good to talk to you, buddy.
Thanks. You too.
Well, before we get started with this week's show, we have two little things that we want to mention. First of all, if you heard our recent show about The Get Down and you got the show soon after it first dropped, you may have heard a little error that we meant to mention last week that I forgot to call out. If you heard it go by that Rob Kardashian's fiance, Blac Chyna, is the ex-girlfriend of one of Rob's ex-boyfriends, you might have said, huh? That is not accurate. What we meant to say was that Blac Chyna is the ex-girlfriend of one of Rob's sister's ex-boyfriends. So if that was confusing, now you know what happened. So we're just going to clear that up, little correction. Second, and much more fun. Oh, this is so much more fun.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much more fun, and it's so much more important. People of the West Coast, please note a little announcement we dropped into the podcast feed yesterday about the fact that we are coming to a few of your fine cities in the month of October.
Woo!
Yay! Woo! Specifically, we will be in Seattle on Monday, October 17th. We will be in Portland on Wednesday, October 19th. We will be in San Francisco on Friday, October 21st. And we will be in Los Angeles on Sunday, October 23rd. Will there be special guests? There will be special guests. In Portland and in Seattle, we will be with our pal for life, one of the best fourth chairs ever, our pal Audie Cornish.
Yay.
The great and good Audie Cornish will be with us in Portland and in Seattle.
She's great live.
She's so good live.
She is wonderful live. So if you are up there in that corner of the country, that is who you will see with us. Now, in San Francisco, also exciting. Ooh. Less familiar to us, but super exciting also. Glenn has a face of utter anticipation. So you may know her from her writing at her own site. You may know her as Prudence over at Slate, where she gives advice. That's right, with us in San Francisco, Mallory Ortberg.
Ooh.
Now, in Los Angeles, also very exciting for us. Friend of the show, all-around good dude, and my frequent Twitter bantering partner on the topic of romantic comedies, the fine Kumail Nanjiani.
Oh,
will be with us, the very funny, the very smart Kumail Nanjiani will be with us in L.A.
We are appearing with people we would pay to see.
Absolutely. We're very, very excited. So tickets to all of those shows will be available this coming up Tuesday. That is September 6th. 2016, if you're keeping track at home. And that's at noon Pacific. So it's noon Pacific on September 6th, Tuesday. Those will all be available at nprpresents.org. They do often sell out in a great big hurry. And in fact, having them sell out in a great big hurry is a big help to us. It shows interest, and we hopefully get to do this again. So buy them up real quick on this coming up Tuesday at noon Pacific.
Day after Labor Day.
Day after Labor Day for all of our four shows in Portland and Seattle and San Francisco and LA. We're excited. Huh? So on to our A topic for this week. FXX's You're the Worst, originally on FX, and then they moved it to FXX. It's a show that started off kind of, I would say, quietly. It gained a lot of critical support over the course of its first season, and then it inspired even more enthusiasm and even more critical writing, I would say, when its second season told an unexpected story about depression. Starring Aya Cash and Chris Gere, it follows two very proud misanthropes who enter into what they intend to be a non-relationship, only to find that it's gotten a little more complicated than they expected. Now, I'm going to go to Stephen, because I know that Stephen has watched a whole bunch of this show just in the last little bit here. Where are you coming down with this right now?
So as you said, I just started watching this show, and I started from the beginning on Friday and finished it up this morning. So I have mainlined 25 episodes of this show.
Right, nice. Because we have seen the first two of the third season, which as this drops, one of them has aired. The other one is the upcoming show for next week.
And my initial reaction to it was dread that I was going to have to watch all 25 episodes.
Why is that?
To me, you mentioned that this show started quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons it starts quietly is I think it takes a few episodes to find its footing. The initial premise of the show seems to be, to steal a line from, I believe, your pal Sarah Bunting, mm-hmm. every garbage can finds its lid.
Yeah, I forget whose line that is.
that the show is sort of built around the premise of this person is awful, this person is awful. You know what would make a perfect couple is to put both of these awful people in one place.
Sure.
And over the course of the show, and about 4 or 5 episodes in, it suddenly takes a turn. It seems to steer away from what I was originally fearing was its premise, which is these are people who are keeping it real.
Mm-hmm.
And over here, you have these fakier people in their fakier relationships who sold out and aren't keeping it real.
Right.
And
that happiness is bogus.
And that being nice to people is bogus.
Right, sure.
And that any attempt to engage with the world is pretense and false.
Sure.
And over time, it drifts farther and farther away from that and becomes a story about growing up.
Yeah.
Coming to terms with normalcy and the fear of normalcy, coming to terms with commitment and the fear of commitment, coming to terms with devotion and the fear of devotion. And it gets richer and warmer without losing that bite
mm-hmm.
that runs through it. These people are not necessarily massively changed. They are largely learning to come to terms with people. And over the course of the second season, which we'll get into, I'm sure, momentarily, mm-hmm. it gets way deeper.
Yeah, I think that's right. Mike, where are you on this show?
I agree with everything Stephen said. I want to sort of jump on that part about growing up, because that's the thing that like resonates the most with me, is characters who are finding themselves firmly in their 30s and kind of realizing that they can't keep acting the way that they've been acting.
Yeah.
They aren't necessarily changing whole cloth. They're not saying, I'm going to change right now. But as these two characters and really kind of the multiple other members of the cast,
right.
they're finding that they're making compromises with their life, or they're deciding that how they've been coping with their own baggage, with their own personality quirks, with their own anger or trauma, or all those things that we'll get to later, it just isn't working anymore. And through their sort of surrogate family that they've sort of created together, or, you know, in some cases, actual relationships, they are slowly changing, or at least like realizing that they cannot fix each other.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But accepting each other, which I think does have a tendency to sort of fix each other too, you know?
Sure. How about you, Glenn?
I was also dreading this show because I had seen it. I'd seen a couple episodes of the first season back when it came on, and it didn't grab me because I thought this was going to be a show about them coming together. And it's actually a show about them trying to stay together. And that's always more interesting to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You've said that
yeah,
before.
Yeah, that's always more interesting to me than a rom-com. I read somewhere that the character of Jimmy, one of the two leads,
uh-huh.
was not intended to be British, but the producers just loved this guy, Chris Gere. I, too, love this guy, Chris Gere.
Yeah.
He is what turned it around for me. I mean, everybody's on the show is good, but I'll pinpoint it at episode 8 of the first season, which is called Finish Your Milk. There is a scene where he is allowed to lean into the preening pomposity that he is so good at,
mm-hmm.
and also allowed to lean into the goofiness. There are moments when he feels particularly self-satisfied that he gets this expression on his face, which is just such a joy to watch.
Yeah.
It is goofy Jimmy is my favorite Jimmy. When we meet his family in the second season, I believe, we start to understand this character in a bigger way. It's big. It does not suffer, I don't think, from second banana syndrome, however. Like a show like Will and Grace, the Jack and Karens are much more interesting than the two leads. That's not true here. I find, in many cases, that the character, particularly of Lindsay, seems bigger, broader, more cartoonish, less appealing. Nothing wrong with the actress, but that character just doesn't necessarily always feel like she belongs in this show. This is how you get me into a comedy about people coming together. You dump this much acid over it.
And I'm in.
that part is definitely Glenn Weldon. I want to defend the character of Lindsay. Wonderful actress, Heather Donahue. Mm-hmm. I enjoy so much on this show.
Yeah.
She's so weird.
It's such a weird performance.
I love it, so weird.
She is going through a process as well. Mm-hmm. And she's going through it differently. She's the main...
She's married when the show opens.
She is the best friend of Gretchen, played by Aya Cash, and they were like party people together, and they you hear all about their former hijinks and everything. And in the process of growing up and getting older, the character of Lindsay kind of has her life fall apart a little bit, and you see her trying to build an adult life from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And by nothing, I don't mean like no resources. I mean like no life skills at all. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way it parallels some of the other processes. There's also, we should mention, of course, the character of Edgar, who is a
vet,
a military veteran with PTSD, living in Jimmy's house.
Amazing house.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is incredible. A nice house.
Amazing.
It is an incredible
house.
Which they explain away at some point why Jimmy would have an amazing house.
But... He's a writer. He's a writer. And I think he got a big advance for his book. And I think there's some other money also.
Maybe. Yeah. And Edgar, who starts out as just this kind of tortured schlub, he's coming out of the depths that he's been in as well. So everybody is moving through something on this show.
This was an interesting show for me because the creator of the show, Stephen Falk, is somebody who I know a little bit, was a recapper at Television Without Pity at the same time I was. I used to recap Fraternity Life and Sorority Life, as well as a bunch of much better shows. But those are the ones that I enjoy mentioning. And we don't know each other. Like, we're not friends in the sense that, like, we don't hang out.
Right.
But we are definitely acquaintances. We have close friends in common. And so it was really interesting to me to see somebody that I knew create a show that then got all this buzz around it. And for me, when I first saw it, I kind of thought kind of the same thing as Glenn. I was kind of like, this is not really for me. And I think for some of the reasons that Stephen is talking about, that I don't necessarily love the sort of horribleness of people for its own sake as a hook for a show. But I think the longer the show went on, the more it became really surprisingly compassionate. And it is very much a show about the importance of being able to tolerate kindness both for other people and by other people towards yourself. That is not the only theme of the show, but it is a theme of the show. And I think this is where we can kind of introduce the storyline from the second season. And this is a spoiler from the second season if you haven't watched it. But in the second season, we learn that Gretchen has dealt with depression for a really long time. And she has sort of the kind of issue where it comes and goes a little bit.
Yeah.
It'll show up and then it fades and comes back. And one of the things I love about that storyline, there are a bunch of things I love about it. I think it's a very sophisticated and thoughtful treatment of mental illness, which is really not that common on television. But I also love the fact that the way that these people meet, you sort of get the impression they're kind of, it's these two peas in a pod. It's this two peas in a pod idea. It's this kind of, well, they're perfect for each other because they're the same, right? They both hate everyone. And what you learn over time is his seems, so far at least, his seems more to be history, that he kind of got this way through a combination of his legitimate personality, but also his history. Like Glenn said, there's family stuff. The explanation comes more from his experiences in life.
Right.
Again, some of it is personality, some of it is experience, but hers has much more of a chemical component than his does. And I really like the idea that these people, although they seem very similar, have actually some very different reasons for winding up in this situation where it's so hard for them to relate. There are some scenes in that second season, particularly late in that second season, where it is almost overwhelmingly emotional to me.
Yes.
I cried a lot at one of these episodes because there is this wonderful moment where for him, this growing up process allows him to be kind to someone, and for her, it allows her to accept that from someone, mm-hmm. and you can see that kind of happening at the same time.
I know the exact scene you're talking
and
about.
And that's when they suddenly seem well matched. It's not because they hate people the same way. It's because they manage to kind of mature in a direction that allows them to connect. And that's what I really love about it.
Can we talk about the show's use of sex?
Absolutely.
Don't watch this on a plane. Don't watch this show, say, at the office.
Not the first one of the third season in particular.
Absolutely.
Find a way to watch the 25 episodes you needed to watch of this show in one weekend around your children.
Yeah, it's really bracingly graphic, I would say.
Yeah.
And as the writer Alan Gurganus always says, in American life, in American fiction especially, we tend to cut to the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
But that denies a creator, a writer, a showrunner from showing us how they have sex. How they have sex tells us a lot about character, tells us a lot about their situation, tells us a lot about how they feel in that moment. And this show does not shy away from that in any of those, though sometimes I wish it would.
Yeah, there's a sex scene right at the beginning of this third season that just started. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, there's stuff like this in the pilot, and then it had become less like that for a really long time. And so when we had Stephen Falk at press tour with the cast, somebody said, why can you talk about this? Because all the critics were talking about Har Har. I was trying to watch it on the plane, all this other stuff. And he basically said, I felt like it was important because of where we left them at the end of the second season. I felt like it was important to show that, like, they were still connecting. They were still hot for each other. They still had this relationship. And it's important for that to be part of it. Because if you try to show a relationship like this that starts as a one-night stand, that is so driven by sexual chemistry at first, and you don't talk about the fact that they still like having sex with each other, you start to wonder whether you really believe that they're still there if they're not prepared to acknowledge that it's because they love each other.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That sexual chemistry is so sort of integral to their dynamic as much as their, like, zinging banter between the two of them. Like, they found each other sort of sexually first, and then they've, like, progressively become well-matched in the way that they interact, the way that they sort of outwardly are mean-spirited to other people, but sort of find each other in the middle both ways. And I think especially the way that the last season story arc ended, it would have been a big deal if that had, like, winnowed away. You know, that would have been, like, a different direction for this upcoming season. I think what they're sort of hinting at with this season is whether her approach to trying to get help or, like, the compromises they've sort of made to each other, whether that can last.
Yeah.
I think, you know, is she serious about trying to work through, you know, the upkeep that is keeping, you know, her depression or her anxieties sort of at bay, like, with the idea that she assumes, I guess, that it can just get cured, and that's not true at all.
Right, and they talk about meds, but not only about meds, and all of that stuff he's gotten into.
And he goes through every process in clueless but well-meaning partner, trying to figure out how to navigate someone's, and, like, going through the snap out of it and cheer up and all of the things that
and
are...
And the I'll do something really special for you.
Once
and
I do something nice, you'll feel better. I want to get back quickly to a point that Glenn made that I think is really right on the money, which is the how people have sex tells you a lot about them. I mean, part of what's interesting about their sex life as it unfolds through this show is there's a lot of very mundane daily intimacy and sort of stuff that they're perfectly happy to do around each other in ways that other couples don't necessarily do. And it's kind of a sign of what makes them a surprisingly high-functioning couple in some ways. And the process of this show is them learning how to reveal more and more of themselves.
Right.
There's an episode where, like, he realizes she can speak Spanish, you know, and they're constantly finding these things out about each other. And the sex is kind of a precursor to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I rewatched the pilot for this conversation. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that what you see is a kind of bravado where all of the willingness to reveal yourself, because that's really what this You're the Worst title is all about, is talking about all the ways in which they're terrible people the first night that they meet. And a lot of that willingness to reveal yourself in the course of a long relationship, that willingness to reveal yourself comes from trust. Mm-hmm. In the course of a one-night stand, it comes from absence of stakes.
Yep.
And so they're kind of
Once you've established that lack of stakes, it's really hard to then take it back and be like, okay, but what if we wanted to act like there were stakes? What if we really wanted to know each other? One of the things I love about this show is you hear stuff go by in the dialogue that you just say, now, see, that happened in someone's life because that is too specific for a writer to have made it. For me, the big one in the third season premiere is the thing about washing your legs. About whether or not you wash your legs. Like, it's sort of, do you specifically wash your legs or do you just, like, your legs get clean because you're in the shower and
water
soap is running
down?
And I thought, as soon as I saw that, I thought, that happened to someone. Yep. I don't know who it is, but that happened to someone because it's too weird to be something that just came up in the writer's room.
But I love that in shows where, like, that's specificity becomes so universal. Like, everyone has, like, those, like, weird quirks that we all
discover
about.
It'll make you think about whether you wash your legs or not.
And that sets up my favorite mode of Jimmy, which is affronted Jimmy.
Yeah.
He is so good. You know, in a way, this is kind of inverted catastrophe, right? British guy, American woman, as opposed to the reverse. Now, they probably hate to hear that because the show came out before catastrophe, but if you have even a thin Anglophilic nature, like a thin thread of being an Anglophile, his Britishness just feeds me in a way that I really, really like. I also want to shout out two other performances, not the second Bananas, but the third Bananas. Brandon Michael Smith as Sam, a client of Gretchen's.
Because she is a music publicist.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Everything out of that guy's mouth is written and performed exceedingly well. And Janet Varney as Becca. This performance, she greets the world with a glare. And it's so sustained.
This is Jimmy's ex.
Jimmy's ex.
And Lindsay's sister.
Whose wedding they meet at.
Yes. Oh, it's every time she's on screen, it's just a delight because she is so angry.
And I don't think we should refrain from talking about Edgar.
Yeah.
Edgar was my way into the show as somebody who felt like it was spitting acid in my face for the first few episodes. Having the undercutting of this kind of galumphing, clumsy sweetness.
But a very gentle soul.
A very, very gentle soul.
And loyal friend, too.
And, and a very loyal friend and somebody who is much kinder to people than they deserve.
Yeah.
But then the way that they have been able to add richness to his character, and like, I find I am very invested in small victories in his life.
Yeah.
And that was my first, like, okay, I like this person. I'm going to fixate on this person. And then I came to like other people more and more.
Yeah. So I will be curious to hear, I know a lot of you who listen to the show have watched You're the Worst. As I said, with Superstore last week, this is one I picked up off of a lot of other critic recommendations. So I'll be curious to hear how many of you are watching it, what you think of it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and let us know what you think. Now, when we come back, we've talked about the way that this show mixes comedy and drama. We're going to talk a little bit generally about the mixing of comedy and drama right after this. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Roadie, the first on-the-way delivery network that connects people who have items to send with drivers heading that way. Roadie is an easy, convenient, and cost-effective way to get door-to-door delivery for items big and small. Roadie lets you track deliveries in real time and offers up to $10,000 in protection on every shipment. Get a free estimate in seconds, download the Roadie app on iPhone or Android device, or visit roadie.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In our first segment, we talked about You're the Worst, which has had some very funny moments as well as a lot of very dark ones. That's increasingly common on television, and it strains everything from network marketing to awards designations. The first thing that I want to talk about is sort of timely because it's not going to be too long before we're getting Emmys. In some ways, to me, it feels like the awards stuff is where these divisions become the most obviously bogus.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether they really are bogus. What do you think, Glenn?
I thought about a show called Difficult People, which we've talked about before. In a lot of sitcoms, it seems like the writers and producers believe that characters are lobbing jokes at one another, like tennis ball throwing machines or whatever. And they just stand there in this affectless void, never reacting to what the other person says. You've written about this before, I think. How important it is for when somebody says a joke for another character to laugh.
Yes.
Because that is a human thing.
Right.
Just in this last episode of Difficult People, we get a moment like that, which is great. In a show as joke-dense as Difficult People is, it could really just be an onslaught.
Sure.
You need a moment like that to give the characters room to breathe. Now, there's not a lot of serious stuff in Difficult People, at least on the surface. There's a hell of a lot of pain between the mother and the daughter
right.
on that show. And it's sometimes allowed to come to the surface. It's mm-hmm. sometimes allowed to breathe so that it can be dealt with in jokes. I talk a lot about the difference between sentiment and sentimentality. I am against sentimentality, which is reaching for emotion, trading on this manipulation of emotion. All art manipulates your emotions. That's what makes it art. But when it's not earned, that's sentimentality. Feeling is belongs in any comedy because feeling is how you get stakes. Feeling is how you turn these characters from joke machines into people. And that's what I think a show that kind of hovers at between the two genres, like this one, like Difficult People, like, I guess, Nurse Jackie.
Nurse Jackie's like this, yeah.
Which is a lot more drama than comedy. So, yeah, that's where we're living right now. I don't have an answer to you, but I don't think there's a clear demarcation anymore, yeah. And that's okay.
Yeah. How about you, Mike?
I think to most audiences, like forgetting the awards, most audiences I don't think even care anymore either.
Mm-hmm.
I think good shows are just good shows, and dramas can be deeply funny. Like, the most dramatic shows can be deeply funny, and comedies can have heart and sadness and all sorts of things, sometimes in the same hour, sometimes episode to episode. And I just see, like, You're the Worst is part of a sort of general trend that is happening where maybe 30-minute shows are now considered comedies regardless of
right.
actual content, and yeah. hour-long shows are considered dramas because that's how it's always been. But those lines are blurring so much. Girls is considered a comedy, but it's more dramatic. Master of None is sort of in that same way.
Yeah.
I actually want to bring into this a strange little bit of historical precedent. In the, I want to say late 80s, early 90s, there were a couple of TV shows launched at the same time. There was Hooperman, starring John Ritter, and there was Slap Maxwell MD, yeah. starring Dabney Coleman.
I have never heard of any of these
shows. No, they did not last very long.
Yeah.
They were launched as dramedies. And it was like, is this a new thing? We're going to try this crazy thing about these funny, dramatic shows. And I remember the reaction to them being people, you know, at least critics, like very confused by the tone. Now, basically, everything falls
yeah.
somewhere on that spectrum. When I think of all my favorite shows, there's some component, almost all of my favorite shows, there's some component of both. I would say there's yeah. not a lot of drama in Archer.
And I think, but I think that's always been, I mean, I think that's always been true, right, up to a point. Particularly, I mean, if you look at it as dramas like Hill Street Blues, right, they would have moments
yeah.
that were supposed
Roots
to be comedic.
Levity.
If you, I think even going back to like shows like cop shows. I think cop shows in the 70s and 80s typically had sometimes jokes.
And there was certainly drama in MASH and Barney Miller.
Absolutely.
All in the Family.
And you had it, and All in the Family. So you had, it's not a new thing. I think what's a new thing is that it's less a component into something that's clearly one thing or the other. And it's more, like Mike said, it's more a thing that doesn't necessarily live in either place. Because All in the Family, even though it contained moments of drama, was structured and built and it signaled that it was comedy
yes.
by the fact that you could hear people laughing and by the fact that, what you know, it had signifiers and act breaks that kind of built on its comediness for the most part. And what's funny is you can look at things that were a little bit format breaking for that, right? And believe it or not, one of the ones that came to mind for me was Love Boat, right? Which was an hour long. It had yeah. it had a laugh track,
mm-hmm.
and it would have sometimes sad stories, but mostly like heartfelt stories or comedic stories. And yet it's an hour long. It was shot on film as opposed to on tape, which was very common for sitcoms at that time. So there have always been things that didn't entirely have every piece of cultural mm-hmm. signaling that goes with either a drama or a comedy. And I think in movies, that's been much more, nobody's ever expected to be able to look at a movie and necessarily say, this is a drama or this is a comedy. Mm. Even though some things clearly are dramas
right.
and some things clearly are comedies,
right.
it doesn't have that same, there's not the same sense that you're supposed to neatly know which it is. And in fact, at the Golden Globes, when you suddenly see movies split into a drama
yeah.
versus
yeah.
a comedy, it feels kind of weird because they don't do that at the Oscars.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing is that means at the Golden Globes, comedies get awards, which they don't at the Oscars.
Right.
But it does feel weird sometimes to see people try to figure out, especially, and this is complicated by the fact that they lump comedies in with musicals and make a bunch of weird decisions around that. But it is sometimes strange to look at it and be like, you know, if you take a movie like The Big Short,
sure.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly supposed to be funny at a bunch of points, but I wouldn't. But it's also supposed to be deeply depressing.
Right.
And I think people in movies are much more accustomed to that, whereas television had a much neater, as you said earlier, if it was a half an hour, it was a comedy. If it was an hour, it was a drama.
Yep.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is anything. They say that television is a writer's medium and film is a director's medium, meaning that's who really shapes your
perception.
It used
to be more true than it is. But
I think that's true because when you are mixing comedy and drama, you run the risk of really varying the tone so much so that the show doesn't feel cohesive.
Uh-huh.
I think nowadays, that's the director's job, is to unify the tone or at least vary the tone so that it feels like you're still in the same universe. I would say that a show like You're the Worst and the other shows we mentioned that do walk that line have a lot to do with the direction, not just the writing.
Right.
I think it's telling, and I'm not sure what it's telling about, maybe just me personally. If I were to keep a TV diary over the course of the years, and mark down every time a show made me cry. First of all, I would run out of pens.
Mm-hmm.
But like how much more often I cry at comedies, TV comedies, mm-hmm. than I do at dramas. Maybe part of it is that I watch more TV comedy than I do drama, but like things that have really, really gotten me. You're the Worst is the latest example. Transparent. I find parts of Transparent almost suffocatingly sad. Parks and Rec. That is a show that really, it invests you so deeply in those characters, and it does that through laughter. That they're using that. They're using comedy as an emotional weapon in a way by endearing you to the characters so much that when they get whatever the good version of comeuppance is,
yeah, sure.
You're invested in it. It's meaningful
sure.
to you. It is an emotional payoff in a way that sometimes like more straight drama doesn't have that resonance for me. And I think that in a way it's like comedy is just buttering you up for these, like, to me, much deeper and grander emotional payoffs. Even in like a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, another show that made me cry a whole lot, has
yeah.
a lot of comedic elements, and I think that's one mm-hmm. reason that it affected me as much as it did.
I think from the drama side, the comedy actually helps lighten the tension that's building. If a show is unrelentingly dark, kind of your Netflix Marvel shows or Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
shows I like just fine, but when they're so unrelenting all the time, it actually has like this feeling of like one-upsmanship. They just have to keep building that tension where shows that I like more, your Breaking Bads or even Sopranos, like when they have kind of a format-breaking episode or when they have jokes within that or a cold open that is different in tone,
mm-hmm.
it makes me understand that these people's lives, these characters' lives, are more like us in some ways because
sure.
otherwise, like, the stakes are so high that how
right.
could they possibly laugh at anything? Well,
right.
I don't think there's much funnier than Walt, like, flinging a pizza on the roof in Breaking Bad.
Or running ever.
Yeah.
Being in his underpants in the first scene. You know,
mm-hmm.
like, there's something that helps those dramas when they are able to sort of laugh. I see this actually in comedy, too, where the characters themselves don't know that they're in a comedy. They're just playing it completely straight, and, like,
right.
the situation itself is comedic. There's other times, you know, maybe Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where, like, the characters know that they are funny and kind of react as such.
Yeah.
In drama, that I think that really actually helps is it just helps the audience. It resets your emotions, and then you can raise those stakes again.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there, Mike, because it's really about art holds a mirror up to nature, and the life that we live is not pure comedy, and the
uh-huh.
life that we live
right.
is not pure drama. To get layers of characterization, you need both. You need to let us see a little bit of both, because that's our subjective feeling, that some days are great
yeah.
and some days are not,
yeah.
and some days are funny and some yeah. days are tragic.
All right. Well, again, I'll be curious to hear what all of you think about this, your favorite comedies that are also dramas, your favorite dramas that are also comedies. Find us on Facebook, find us on Twitter, and let us know what you think. Now, when we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from Eloqui, the leading brand for women's plus-size clothing and accessories. Inspired by the belief that all women deserve to have access to high-quality, runway-inspired fashion, Eloqui is the online destination for contemporary, fast fashion in sizes 14 to 28. For 50% off your first item and 40% off everything else, visit Eloqui, ELOQUII.com/happyhour, and use the promo code HAPPYHOUR during checkout.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, first of all, we haven't had a chance in a regular segment to talk about the recent death of Gene Wilder.
Yeah.
And I know this is not obviously... It's always a little awkward when we talk about recent deaths in the happy, but you know, we are in the business of assessing legacies sometime. Gene Wilder had a remarkably happy-making film legacy that we did want to talk about really, really briefly.
Yeah. You've heard a lot about Willy Wonka. He was in a little film called Willy Wonka. People have been talking about that. He was crucial to that film because that film depends on not just being saccharine sweet. It needs a layer of not menace, but
darkness.
Mystery.
Yeah.
You couldn't figure out where he was coming from. That's crucial to that film. He brought that in a big way. And of course, the most beautiful comedy of all time, Young Frankenstein.
Yes.
He is fantastic. He starts out very controlled and then goes into manic hysteria, as is his wont. That was great. Blazing Saddles, of course. I want to point out a couple performances that haven't been talked about a lot, but if you are hankering for a little bit of Gene Wilder this weekend, this is a good place to start. The Frisco Kid is a 1979 film where he plays a Polish rabbi on his way through the Old West, and he meets Harrison Ford, a very young post-Star Wars Harrison Ford. It's funny, not a perfect film, but it's very him. And then The World's Greatest Lover, which he wrote and directed, where he's trying to become like a famous cinema film lover like Rudolph Valentino. It's right. It's in that role. So those are a couple very funny little performances that he's given.
Yeah, and when I've been thinking about Gene Wilder and his legacy, like I came of age as a movie comedy fan with Gene Wilder movies, mm-hmm. like especially like his work with Richard Pryor,
sure.
your movies like Silver Streak. Like those were the first movies I heard about like, oh man, you got to see these. Like mm-hmm. they were a little dirty mm-hmm. and they were and but he was also so able to pull that off in part because of that persona that was honed in a movie like Willy Wonka, where he was also lovable and also warm. And so yeah, it's a major loss and a sad day. And like I said, like it's weird when we talk about deaths and what's making us happy, but it's really important, I think, for us to briefly acknowledge his legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And then for more unalloyed happiness, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, a show that we all know and love. If you like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and you have Spotify, they not only have a playlist of all the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend songs, which I know Glenn has ranked,
mm-hmm.
But each one accompanies a commentary about the song by the makers of the song. And that show lends itself so well to that kind of deep dive. If you love it, I want to make sure you know it's out there. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend songs on Spotify.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
There's a really wonderful essay on lithub.com called How a Self-Published Writer of Gay Erotica Beat Sci-Fi's Sad Puppies at Their Own Game. Now, if you know nothing about any of that, that is a mystifying headline. I didn't know much about this. There's a controversy with the Hugo Awards. It's mystifying to me, and this enlightened me. This is a great explanation of exactly what happened, and it's also a really fascinating insight into a guy by the name of Chuck Tingle, who to me has been a punchline for the last couple of years. Yo, he writes dinosaur porn, ha ha ha. So obviously it's funny just to read these titles, but titles such as Pounded by President Bigfoot, Space Raptor Butt Invasion, Seduced by Dr. Bigfoot, Attorney at Large, which think about that for a second. And then, of course, the pithy Schrodinger's Butt. Now, he has been producing these ebooks, self-published ebooks that he sells on Amazon, about 2 to 3 a month, and he is just this fascinating guy. Many people thought he was just like a performance artist, right? Or this was a character, this was a bit, but there was recently a AMA, an Ask Me Anything on Reddit, with his son. His son says that he's a autistic savant, that he's also schizophrenic. It's so fascinating that this guy lives in the world, is producing what he's producing, and has become a central part of this Hugo Awards controversy. So if you need guidance through all of that tangled mass, this essay called How a Self-Published Writer of Gay Erotica Beat Sci-Fi's Sad Puppies at Their Own Game is a really good essay that also talks about writer's block, it goes in a personal direction that the writer does. It's really, really nice. So
thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Mike Katziff, what is making you happy this week?
Okay, so this one sort of comes out of the old things that are new to me department. So after watching Stranger Things, I, like a lot of people, obviously saw the connections to people like Steven Spielberg, but also Stephen King, which has put me lately in the mood to revisit Stephen King, because it's been probably 10 years since I've read anything by him. So I briefly entertain the Dark Tower series, which is way too sprawling, and I probably should actually read like Harry Potter first before I get into like an actual like book series. So I decided with something maybe equally as daunting, but at least more self-contained, which is The Stand.
Oh, I love
so,
The Stand.
I've decided to read the so-called, like, the complete and uncut edition, which was republished in 1990. There's an original version that had maybe 150,000 words, according to Wikipedia, that were cut from the original book that he then added back. So my goal for the next, I don't know, ten years is to read this 1,152-page book. I even entertained the idea of, like, the audiobook, but that is literally 48 hours of listening, so... It's post-apocalyptic, it's kind of a contagion story, an outbreak story, and then watching society sort of break down. I'm very new to this book so far, like 70 pages in, but I'm pretty pumped to dig in.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Mike Katziff. Yeah. I enjoy The Stand very much myself. I'll be curious to hear how you like it.
I'll let you know in 5 years.
I got two things this week. One real quick is Single by 30, which is a rom-com on YouTube. It is very much billed as a show for millennials, about millennials. It stars Harry Shum Jr., who you might know from Glee or other things. And it's about this man and this woman who, when they're in high school, they make one of these pacts that if they're not married, when they're 30, they'll marry each other, which is a ridiculous gimmick, as many rom-coms begin with. It's actually pretty charming. I liked it. It's on YouTube Red, which is their premium service. Last time I looked, the first episode was still free. You can see if you like it. I liked the second episode more than the first. I've seen two. It's fun. It's not great, but it kind of scratched a simple rom-com itch that that sometimes does not get scratched for me very often by television anymore. The other thing is I've seen three episodes of Queen Sugar, which is going to be on OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network, really created for television by Ava DuVernay, based on a novel. She has lined up a bunch of really good directors. She directed the first episode herself. She also did some of the writing. It's really good. It's a family story about a family that has to kind of regroup after the dad can no longer care for the sugar farm slash plantation that they have had for a long time. And there's a lot of just very, very good stuff in it. I like the performances. I like the writing and the directing. It's gorgeous to look at, as you might expect. So Queen Sugar, coming soon to OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Mike at Mike Katziff. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _ Reedy. And of course, Mike remains our producer emeritus and music director, and his band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you're looking for a new podcast, check out How to Do Everything. It's a survival guide for all of life's trials and tribulations, like bear attacks, romantic conundrums, and romantic bear attacks. You may well find it helpful, and you'll definitely enjoy hearing about other people's problems. Find Mike and Ian now on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts.